In the world of medicine, where every decision can change lives, your peace of mind is crucial. This is where Pattern steps in. Imagine insurance made simple, fast, and personalized, just for you. With Pattern, you're not just getting disability and life insurance, you're insuring your future and protecting your greatest asset, your income. In the past 10 years, Pattern has transformed the way over 20,000 doctors secure their financial well-being. Discover the simplicity of securing your future at patternlife.com or click the link in the description. What's the most efficient way to start making more money in private practice? By optimizing your billing practices and collecting what you're owed. Find out how. Hey, this is Brad Block, host of The Physician's Guide to Doctoring. This is a personal and professional development podcast for physicians where we have experts on the show that try to teach us everything we should have been learning while we were memorizing Krebs cycle. Welcome back to the podcast. On today's episode, we have Dr. Heather Signorelli. She's a board-certified pathologist and physician executive overseeing labs in an extensive healthcare system. Dr. Signorelli is also an entrepreneur who enjoys building businesses and owns a full-service medical billing and coding company with her husband, and that's what we're going to be talking about today, everyone's favorite subject, revenue cycle management. She's committed to helping physicians learn the business side of medicine through her podcast, RevMD, so they can grow their revenue. In 2022, Dr. Signorelli was awarded the Top 40 Under 40 by Modern Healthcare, and she's committed to supporting the improvement of billing processes and educating physicians on medical billing and coding tips. So Dr. Signorelli, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me. Excited to chat with you guys about something that I know everybody is so excited to talk about.
So excited. Myself, I was not familiar with coding because, of course, we don't learn that in residency. And the way that I forced myself, because I just didn't want to do it. Right. I didn't want to sit there and learn it. So I joined our compliance committee. So it forced me to look at other people's charts. And in order to be able to like blow through charts quickly, I had to come up with a system to be able to see. And then you know what happened? They changed the system. So now coding is different. I mean, and that's not what we're going to be talking about today. This is not a lesson on coding. It's actually all about medical decision-making now, but that's a whole nother episode. This is about revenue specifically. So first, tell us about the origin of National Revenue Cycle Management.
Yes. So about 2 years ago, my husband and I was actually at a conference with some other physicians. He was with me and we were chatting with some physicians who were struggling with revenue. The revenue was going down. It was just after COVID. And initially I thought, gosh, it has to be related to patient volume or COVID and all the things. And actually it was just had to do with plain and simple medical billing processes and efficiencies in the practice. And so my husband's got a background in tech. I've got a background in business and we can go into all of that stuff and really realize that we could be doing this better. Like we could actually be helping physicians with a reliable service. And so about 2 years ago, my husband quit his job and he runs the company full time. And I just have, you know, a passion for helping docs be able to stay independent if that's what they want to do.
But don't you work for a larger healthcare system? Isn't that at odds with like what that larger healthcare system wants? They don't want people to stay in a thriving private practice. They want it to go under so they can absorb them inexpensively.
It's a line. There's a drawn line there. You know, when I was in residency, I started out obsessed with the business side of medicine. I was consulting. I was flying around all over the country, helping labs become more efficient, helping them improve their revenue.
Wait, how did you do that right out of residency? Who's asking a resident how to run a lab?
I was actually doing it in residency. So I was literally flying on these little itty bitty planes out to rural areas of Canada and helping labs go in and check them out. I mean,
but why were they asking you, a resident?
I have had a knack for the business side and kind of got connected with these attendings that were helping kind of groom me to learn the business side. So they would teach me things and then they were like, okay, go forth, go visit these labs, go evaluate them, write up the report. And so they were mentoring me along the way, kind of teaching me, but then I was kind of doing the dirty work. And so it was an awesome experience.
That's great. I mean, it sounds like a management consulting company where you've got your like lower level consultants who go out there and then they collect the data and they bring it back to their bosses who then come up with the reports, who then bring it to the company, who then goes on to ignore it.
Exactly. All of those things. And so then I went to go get a job where I moved up quickly in the ranks running clinical laboratories for a large healthcare system. And so learned kind of the contracts, the business side of things, and then kind of melded that with my husband's experience on the tech side and built a medical billing company. We have about 35-ish employees now. So we serve about 15 practices, and it's grown pretty rapidly in the last 2 years, but it's been awesome. It's been fun.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And I'm sure it helps that you, like a physician, you're kind of the face of the organization, because physicians trust other physicians. Like, oh yeah, I've got a background in programming and tech. I can help you with the revenue cycle management. You're going to kind of sound like other companies, but you as the physician, you're like, oh, she gets it. She's a physician like me.
And it's funny, you know, what I thought would be helpful 2 years ago when we started this has not been what has made us succeed. One of the biggest things is that practices, they move so fast, and you have to. You're seeing patients, you're managing a front office, everything moves so fast. But sometimes it's actually slowing down and helping the physicians understand the clinical side and how the revenue cycle side kind of fits into that. And sometimes physicians won't listen to our billing team, right? So sometimes our billers and our coders who've been doing this, you know, for decades, some of them, they kind of give them the runaround, or they don't really understand. And so sometimes if I sit down and talk with them and I say, hey, let me explain this to you, it allows, I think, everybody to really grasp the big picture of how their workflow is actually impacting their revenue, how what they're documenting in their chart is impacting their revenue. And so, it, you know, I didn't really anticipate it being all about that, but it's been a large part of our success is to go, hey guys, we really need to understand this part of your workflow. Here's some suggestions to improve on that so that you can actually succeed and do better.
Yeah, it makes sense. Oh, it sounds like this is what was going on with the patient. And so if you documented X, Y, and Z also, you're going to be able to bill a higher level of care. This was clearly what was going on. And because you didn't document that, you were not able to get to this level of coding. So you know that because you can picture the patient scenario in your mind because you've been there, whereas a coder doesn't have that level of sophistication a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's just the way you say things sometimes. And again, our coders and billers are phenomenal. I mean, it is a symbiotic relationship, but they sometimes it's, you know, Heather, can you get on the call with, you know, the physician and help get us where we need to be? Okay, yep, I got it.
Okay, so maybe they do understand those scenarios, but it's just you're more likely to listen to another physician.
Yeah, or just how you say it, right? It's you may be saying the same thing, but it's how you say it sometimes comes across differently. So
interesting. All right. Well, let's talk more about some advice that we can give to our physician listeners about their practices. So let's just start off with the fact that it just seems billing and coding just seem like I had to force myself to learn coding because I would just like stare at it and not learn anything because it just seems so opaque and uninteresting. So try and change my mind. Help me out here.
Well, it's what brings money in the door. So I think at the end of the day, it is dry. I mean, it is, you know, rules and regulations that change. They want to make it tricky for us. I think we're not taught this in medical school. And so you have to kind of put on this, I'm just going to do it and it's going to be okay. And it does get easier. I mean, if you were to look at what you knew, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago versus what you know now, it's more second nature. It's not a big deal. And that's the same thing with the knowledge you can learn with diving into a few key things and looking at a few key items in your practice. And then if you get those things down, you're going to be okay. You don't have to be the expert, you know, hire a coding group to help audit whatever you want, but you have to have certain skills and certain baseline knowledge in order to run a practice these days. And it's just not negotiable. So whether it is the boring stuff, it's just kind of the stuff you got to do to succeed.
Yeah, it sounds like the 80-20 rule. You just have to know like 20%, get 20% of the really important stuff right, and that'll help you 80% of the time. And I think that's the 80-20 rule. I'm not totally sure.
It'll work. I mean, 80-20 can work in a number of different ways. So I like
my math is math. So, okay. before we take the really deeper dive, let's say I'm a resident or a fellow, or I'm an attending in a practice and I'm looking to make a lateral move to a different practice. And I'm trying to assess the health of the practice. So I'm going to want to look at their books, right? What are some of the things that I'm going to be looking for, some of the metrics? Because also we'll be able to do that in our own practice to tell if we have a healthy practice. So what are these like key practice indicators that I should be looking for or asking about to see if it's a healthy practice revenue-wise?
So the first thing you want to ask, and again, this can be you in your own practice or you're looking to evaluate in other practices, are you tracking anything? Just baseline, like first, you know, question is help me understand how you guys measure the success of your billing team on a monthly basis. Are you following metrics? How often do you meet with your billing team? What do those metrics look like? And we can dive into some of those key metrics. But high level, really just understanding, does the practice or does the office have an in-house team or an outsourced team? And that just helps you understand access to that team. Are they in the building? Are you getting on phone calls? Both can work. It's just nice to know that. And then are they looking at metrics every month? And is it something that you're going to have access to, right? So if you're a new resident or if you're a physician who's coming over to this practice, are you going to be able to have access to your own productivity? Because it's nice to see that. I mean, you know, most physicians want to see, okay, what did I bill out this month? What did I collect? And how does that impact the practice? How does that track and trend month over month? You know, especially if you're new coming into a practice, you know, you're wanting to see those metrics every month so you can see, how's my volume doing? Is it increasing? And so really getting an understanding of just making sure a practice is looking at that. That would be the first thing. The second is, okay, now you say, you know, hopefully the practice is like, yep, you know what? We've got metrics. We look at them monthly. Okay, tell me about, you know, these three. And the three that I would really focus on really has to do with accounts receivable. And you want to look at both your, so I'll slow down. Accounts receivable is the money that's due to you, right? So that's the money that you've charged out to the insurance companies or to the patients. That's the money that's sitting in the bucket that hasn't been paid yet. And so the age of that accounts receivable gets really important. The older money gets, the harder it is to get paid to you, right? Makes sense. So you really want to understand, once you know that the practice or a practice is, you know, looking at metrics, what does their accounts receivable look like? And a metric that you can ask and focus on is accounts receivable over 90 days. So that's the bucket of money, right, that's due to you, that's over 90 days old. And the percentage that you want to keep that under is 20%. And that just means that, you know, there's no more than 20% of your AR that's over 90 days old.
That sounds like a lot. 20% is 90 days old because you're not likely to get paid any of that. So that means the money that you're owed is more than 90 days, like that you're not collecting on 20% of your revenue.
You will get that. It's just, remember, insurance companies will, depending on how long it takes for them to pay you, some of that is always going to be over 90 days. I mean, that's not an atypical. I mean, sometimes we'll walk into practices and 50, 60, 70% of their AR is over 90 days. So yeah. And a lot of that is going to depend on the type of practice you have. Is it more surgical? Is it
surgical revenue? Definitely takes longer. Yeah.
Lower hospital revenue takes longer. Those things just take longer to pay. Now, if a portion of that AR over 90 days is your patient AR, that's a red flag that you've got to work on your upfront collections so that you can get paid sooner. Insurance AR over 90 days can sometimes be because of denials or because, you know, you just need to work the accounts. So it just depends. Some of the commercial payers just take longer to pay. So it just depends.
And that might be something that should come up in your contract negotiations. Listen, the other payers, they take on average this long to pay and you are lagging way far behind. This is not acceptable and, you know, should be something up for negotiation.
Waxes and wanes, you know, who was a really good payer 6 months ago is now misbehaving. And I don't know what goes on behind the scenes over there, but I was talking to our billing team last week and they were saying, well, we used to love this payer. Now they're, you know, slow. And anyway, I digress. But knowing what your AR looks like is going to be a key metric that you want the practices to really be able to have visibility of. So again, it's, do they have metrics, AR? The next thing to really look at is denials. And this is an important thing for a physician to understand is what is that percent of denials? Is it 5%? Hopefully it's less than that, but it, you know, we've walked into practices where it's much higher than that. And denials can be for a number of different reasons. So you want to make sure, okay, are they tracking metrics? They're tracking AR, and now we're tracking denials. And why are we getting denials? Some practices have very, very minimal denials. Some have really high denials, and it could be eligibility. It could be prior auth. And understanding what those top two or three denials in a practice are helps you understand the operations inside, right? Because if you're walking into an office or you're walking into a practice and they have 10% denials, which is not great, but the majority of those are related to eligibility and prior auth, then you know something's going on either with the billing team or the front office, depending on who's responsible, that you need to figure out what they're planning to do about that, because it will impact your revenue, especially if you're paid on some sort of commission, you know, because you can't get back some of those, that money. If it's, some of those denials are not reversible, depending on what they are.
Recruiters calling or texting you nonstop? Want to find the right job without exposing your personal info? Need tools to manage your search all for free? In every industry, there comes a moment when innovation challenges the status quo, ushering in a new era of possibilities. Beginly gets it. They get us. Their platform anonymously matches you with jobs that suit you until you decide to share your info. Customize your job search based on economic factors like salary or cost of living, or non-economic factors like location or nearby stadiums or airports. And their algorithm does the rest, all for free. Ready to find your perfect job? Visit beginleyhealth.com/doctoring. Powered by preference, connected by passion. All right, number three.
All right, number three is going to be your collection rate. And typically, I like to think about this as your net collection rate. So I'll explain what that means. So net collection rate is, okay, so you charge $200 for a 992, whatever, 99213. And your allowable rate is, say, $100, right? So that's the money that the insurance company says that they'll pay you. That's what the contract says. We're making the numbers up.
No, appreciated, but that's often different for different. That's always different for different insurers.
Oh, always different. I'm giving you an example high level, right? So $200 is what you charge out. $100 is what they say they will pay you for whatever CPT code. The amount that you get paid, right? So if you get that full $100 that they say they're going to pay you, your net collection is 100%. So that's why you have to look at that high level at all of your CPTs and all your charges that you bill out. But calculating that, it becomes really important because it talks about the efficiency of your billing process. And usually you want that at 95%. And again, we're calculating that based on your fee schedules that you're getting from all of your different payers. So it's not about what you charge, because that's the funny money, right? I could charge $1,000. It doesn't mean anything. It's about what they're going to pay you. And what's really good is when you are interviewing with these practices is ask them, do you have copies of your fee schedules? Do you keep that? Because I will tell you, the majority of practices don't have these on hand. It is not something that they can pull out. It's not something that's uploaded into their EMRs and their PM softwares. I mean, it's just part of, you know, us trying to realize that that's a major gap in healthcare today. Isn't
there some law about transparency now that like that you have to have something in writing somewhere about how much you charge for services, even though those charges are, as you said, funny money, where we just kind of like make up some extraordinarily high numbers so we never underbill the insurance company?
So that is true, but that is separate, right? So that's the funny money. You have to be transparent about the funny money. But what you may not have transparency in your practice, and I would encourage if you're listening to this and you don't know if your practice keeps your contracts, your fee schedules on hand, to go get them. Like, go talk to the payer reps, get your front office stuff, put a VA on this as a project, get your credentialing team to do it, pull your payer contracts, figure out when they were last renegotiated, when they're up for renegotiation, and get that stuff organized. Where I see practices struggle with this is a certain company will do it. Somebody will get the files, that somebody will leave. And the next thing you know, you've got Debbie's drawers had the contracts. Now we can't find the contracts because Debbie's gone. And that's where you kind of get into this cycle of missing the boat to renegotiate. again, having that information allows you to calculate net collection rates, but it's also one of those just key things that if a practice is able to have access to, it just shows you how well they are operating in general. And again, this is very common to not have these. So if you're listening to me and you're going, shoot, I don't have those, guys, you guys are not alone. This is very common. It's just something you got to put on the 2024 goal list. Like, we're going to go get our payer contracts.
Fix it. So what about the low-hanging fruit? So when you go in and you assess a practice and you're like, whoa, you guys, you're leaving a lot of money on the table here, and some of it we can get you fairly easily. What would that be? Where's that low-hanging fruit?
Oftentimes it's in the front office process. It's not collecting stuff up front. I would say that's the most immediate thing that you can see returns on. And so what I mean by that is, okay, patient ABC comes in, they're getting ready to get seen. If your office is doing an eligibility check, right, so they're checking that the insurance is active, they should also be getting information on, do they owe a $20 copay? Do they have a $100 deductible? All of that fun stuff. And so if they can get all of that money that is due to you or potentially due to you up front and pay it before they even see the doctor, not only is it going to prevent your AR from ballooning, it's going to allow you to capture that before the patient is seen. So they're aware that, you know, hey, I'm paying for services today. This is my responsibility to pay. It can potentially save on invoices that you're having to send out through the clearinghouse, which can be expensive. So collecting as much upfront is just going to help you get your revenue up. And that's an immediate thing you can put into place. A lot of times I see practices either not doing eligibility, not collecting money upfront, or not, what was the last thing I was going to say? Not collecting money up front, or they're not actually looking at the balance sheet to see, oh, they still owe me $100 from the last visit, and so I need to collect that. And so they totally miss the boat on being able to collect that money.
Right. Another patient contact is an opportunity to ask them right when they're in front of you to pony up what you're owed. Anything else? Any other low-hanging fruit?
So other low-hanging fruit, the other thing I was going to say is being able to have an easy way for patients to pay. So the other low-hanging fruit is this very manual process of literally, you know, cash and checks. And I know, you know, for some of you guys, you're going to laugh but that is reality in a lot of these practices still. I mean, we don't have really solid processes put in place to say what? Auto pay? Apple Pay. I mean, seriously, the Apple Pay is, you know, a text message, your statement with a link that says like, here, pay me now. I mean, just really simple ways, because guess what? Like when you make it easy, people are going to pay. Who doesn't have a phone sitting in their hand 24/7? So if it's a text message and you just push a button, you go, oh yeah, I do owe that $30. Okay, here, just take the $30. So you've got to make it easy for people. That's probably another low-hanging fruit, is just taking that very manual process and making sure it's automated. And then the last, I would say, maybe not on the super easy, but easier, is making sure that folks are doing eligibility checks and prior auths if that's needed. Again, a little bit more manual step, but it is the low-hanging fruit in the sense that if you do it and you do it right, you actually get paid. And if you don't do it, you can't get back some of those denials.
Yeah. If you do a procedure without checking first to see if they need an authorization, well, you've done it. They haven't agreed to pay you for it. And because it's in your contract that you need their permission, they're going to take every opportunity to not pay you for services that you've performed.
And you can't fight that. There is no fighting. There is no winning that. The other thing I'll say is that oftentimes patients will come in and they'll say, oh yeah, you know, I got Aetna. Okay, good. I'm in network with Aetna, but they don't actually do the eligibility check. When you do that, and then you don't talk to that patient if they are out of network, and then you see them, and then you get a denial because they're out of network. With the new No Surprises Act, it gets a lot more challenging to then flip that to the patient and say, okay, now you owe me XYZ because of all of the rules and regulations around being upfront about your pricing, telling patients what they're going to have to pay. You miss an opportunity to potentially get paid what you should. So got to get that eligibility check in. It's just one of those things that's just not negotiable.
With regards to different specialties, because you, in your business, you take on a variety of specialties as clients. Are we really different in how we handle revenue, or are we more similar than we think? You know, because some people do a lot of inpatient consults or admissions or procedures or in the operating room or in the office. So there's like a lot of different ways of billing, but ultimately, are we just not that different, or do we tend to be pretty different among specialties?
Can I use your 80-20 rule? Because I really like that in this scenario. So I think 80% of it is similar from practice to practice. I mean, truly, like 80% is going to be the same. The claims process is the claims process. The metrics are the metrics. The KPIs are the same. What becomes different is the coding. And so typically in most practices, the physicians are actually doing the coding. And you'll want to have a biller or a coder, depending on the complexity of your practice, who is what's called scrubbing your claim. So that's looking at it and going, oh, you need this modifier, you need that modifier. Or, you know, there's these guidelines. And a lot of software does this actually for you to some degree. But you'll want to have, you know, a team of people who understand your subspecialty enough to where they can catch things up front and they can clean up denials on the back end. That's kind of where the differences really are. Everything in the middle is really very similar. The scrubbing of the claim in the beginning and then dealing with coding denials on the back end is where things start to get a little tricky depending on the subspecialty. And so for us, for example, we really try and match our billers and coders up with the subspecialties that they are familiar with, because that just makes things easier to manage. It doesn't mean you can't learn it. It's just the time of which it takes to manage something.
It's interesting. Like I'm an otolaryngologist, if I have a patient that comes in and let's say they developed hearing loss in their left ear and they tried to like clean out the wax with a Q-tip. So now they smushed in a bunch of wax. They come into the office, their ear's full of wax. So I've got a bill. I can bill for removing the wax. I remove all that wax and they're like, yeah, actually my ear's still clogged. So now we get them a hearing test. And so to be able to bill wax removal with a hearing test and a visit, the combination of different codes, there are two different codes actually for wax removal. Actually, I think there might even be three, but only two that, you know, are really useful to an otolaryngologist. For each payer, they use different codes, different modifiers, and then how it attaches to the visit is different. Like, it's crazy. And you can't have all this memorized. So you're right, like having some way to review that to make sure, because if I don't do it properly, they're going to be like, well, I know what you did, but because you didn't do it, because you didn't bill it right, I'm not going to pay you. It seems petty, but it's just how they've chosen to create their business model. You got to don't hate the player, hate the game.
Yeah. And I think you just got to get a team of people who know the game, who can play it just as rough.
Speaking of playing the game rough, tell me about timely filing, and I'll tell you why it makes me mad.
Oh, timely filing is frustrating. So timely filing, for listeners who are listening and going, I don't know what that means. So timely filing is when the insurance company says you have X days to submit a claim. And there's kind of two ways you can think of timely filing. There's when you initially submit the claim, and then there's the time at which, if they deny it, that you have to come back to actually manage that denial. And there's payers have very different rules on this. And so I don't even have those memorized. I think we have a sheet or something that the staff use, but Medicare actually has a really long timely filing. It's 365 days. But a lot of other payers have anywhere from 30, 60, 90, 120, 180 days. So it just depends on the payer in terms of how long they give you to submit a claim. And this is why, if you're listening, it's so important to sign out your chart and then have the billing team get those submitted quickly. We see a lot of struggle in that process of, you know, making sure that folks sign out their charts, drop the codes. You know, the billing team scrubs the claims and get it sent out. It's easier now that things are electronic, because you can run a report and we can run a report and say, okay, who's got open charts this week? Like, where are you? Sign out your notes. You know, when you're doing paper claims and stuff, it was a lot harder. But why? I'm curious now.
If I don't submit it in enough time, then they won't pay me for it. But let's say I do submit it, but then it takes them a really long time to pay me. Their repercussions to me for not timely filing. Is there repercussions for them for not timely paying? Can I start charging them interest if it takes them X amount of days to pay me? I guess then you would need to be in the contract. And they'll never agree to that.
You know the answer to that, but unfortunately, no. I mean, and it's, I actually saw this post not too long ago about this exact discussion, because there are some commercial payers right now that aren't normally this slow, but are slower right now in paying physicians. And so that was the discussion. Can I start charging them interest? Of course, the answer is no. However, I really do think that there's some good payer representatives out there that I do think that we underutilize as a healthcare organization. I think physician practices in general underutilize those payer reps. And they actually are very helpful, and they're very good to get to know, have their contact information and ping them, because they can help. I was actually giving a talk at a conference a couple months ago. And actually I was giving this conversation about, you know, metrics and all this stuff. And a group of docs actually were complaining about this one specific payer. Oddly enough, the CMO of that payer was in the room, stood up and was like, I'm going to take all your complaints. And he took all the people out into the hallway and was actually trying to help solve some of the issues, which I thought was very commendable. So,
holy cow, that's jumping on a grenade right there.
I know. I thought he was kidding. I thought he was joking, because he stood up in the middle and everybody was just going off on the specific payer, and he stood up and he took it. And it was actually really impressive. I thought, okay, there's good people out there. You just got to find them in the organizations.
But yeah, I think, you know, finding an individual that works for that company who's going to take ownership, that you can develop a relationship with, and you can use a lot of the tips and tricks from this podcast on communication, on relationship development. You know, we've talked a lot about, you know, patient experience and optimizing the staff experience in order to optimize the patient experience. So use those same ideas for making this person your ally. Get to know who this person is, what they like, you know, who they are as a person, and they'll be more apt to help you because they will, you know, they'll like you.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, and it's true. It is just like in most things with life, it's about who you know, and relationships just tend to go a long way in this field. And so I highly recommend, you know, if you're thinking, gosh, I don't have my payer contracts. Okay, well, you know who to go work with. You work with your payer reps. So it's the same people who can help solve problems, get you your fee schedules. Sometimes they're loaded up onto the payer portal sites themselves, but hang on to those contacts because they can be really useful.
There's one more metric that you hadn't mentioned, and I'm wondering about the significance of it. And I apologize, it escapes me, but it's like the average time it takes to get claims paid.
That's very similar to the age of AR. So average days in AR for the listeners is the number of days it takes to get paid. So again, think about your claim. You're sending in that $200 claim to whatever, United. And if it takes you 25 days on average to get paid, you're doing pretty good. Anything over 40 is getting too long. Again, hospital claims are always going to take longer. Procedures are going to take longer. So there's some of those things that just take longer. So, you know, take my numbers with a grain of salt, depending on the type of practice you have. But average days in AR is a very similar metric to looking at your AR aging buckets. So that's looking at the percentage of AR that's in your 0 to 30 bucket, your 30 to 60, your 60 to 90, over 90. It's the same information. You're just looking at it in a different way. So you can. It's a good metric to look at. It's one that we report out for our practices in their KPI dashboard. It's a different way to skin a cat.
Great, great information. And if we're looking to take a deeper dive, where do we find the podcast?
So podcast is RevMD, R-E-V-M-D, and it's on anywhere you listen to podcasts. And our website is nationalrevenueconsulting.com. And you can get our podcast. And we're actually also going to be doing an 8-week medical billing course for practices starting in January. And so it's going to be something where if you're like, I'm lost, I didn't learn this in medical school, I'm running a practice, I need to know what the heck I'm doing. We're going to be doing that on a weekly basis for 8 weeks starting after the new year.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Signorelli, thank you for all you do to help as a physician in private practice. I love to see more people thriving in private practice. So thank you for all you do for physicians to help us stay that way.
Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Doctors dedicate our lives to caring for others. It's time someone took care of us. Visit patternlife.com to simplify your path to peace of mind. Patternlife.com. Simplifying your insurance journey. Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means you either fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please share it or like it or comment on a social media post or write us a 5-star review, something. It would really help me out. And maybe what you learned from this episode can help someone else too. The views expressed in this episode are those of the interviewer and interviewee and don't represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting make it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice or financial advice or really any advice. Thank us again for listening to The Physician's Guide to Doctoring.